And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today's March 7th, 66th day of the year. 299 days remain till the year's over with. Found out something interesting today. A new area of criminality. People are bribing soda truck drivers to get their hands on Diet Dr. Pepper, which is becoming in very short supply here in Texas, the home of Dr. Pepper. Suggesting that folks are actually bribing the truck drivers. And that came from a truck driver. On this day in 161, Marcus Aurelius Nel Commodus, who changed his name to Lucius Verus, became joint emperors of Rome at the death of Antoninus Pius. 1138, Conrad III von Hohenstaufen, elected king of Germany at Koblenz in the presence of the papal legate, Theodwin. 1277, the University of Paris issues the last in a series of condemnation of various philosophical and theological theses that they didn't agree with. 1573, a peace treaty signed between the Ottoman Empire and Republic of Venice. It ended the Ottoman-Venetian War, left Cyprus in the hands of the Ottomans. 1799, Napoleon Bonaparte captures Jaffa in Palestine, and his troops proceed to massacre more than 2,000 Albanian captives. 1814, Emperor Napoleon I of France wins the Battle of Creon. 1827, Brazilian Marines unsuccessfully attacked the temporary naval base of Carmen de Patagones in Argentina. Also in 1827, Srigley abduction. Ellen Turner's abducted by Edward Gibbon Wakefield, future politician in colonial New Zealand. The little thing like an abduction doesn't have anything to do with keeping you from office. The Srigley abduction was an 1827 British case of a forced marriage by Edward Gibbon Wakefield to the 15-year-old heiress Ellen Turner of Pat Srigley. A couple married in Gretna Green in Scotland traveled to Calais, France, before Turner's father was able to notify the authorities and intervene. Parliament annulled the marriage, and Turner was legally married 2 years later, at the age of 17, to a wealthy neighbor of her class. Both Edward Gibbon Wakefield and his brother William, who'd aided him, were convicted at trial and sentenced to 3 years in prison. Which just goes to show, money will out. 1850, Senator Daniel Webster gives his 7th of March speech endorsing the Compromise of 1850 in order to prevent what he saw as a possible civil war. Now, the Compromise of 1850 was a package of 5 separate bills passed by Congress in September 1850 to defuse a political confrontation between slave and free states on the status of territories acquired in the Mexican-American War. It also set Texas' western and northern borders and included provisions addressing fugitive slaves and the slave trade. Compromise was brokered by Whig Senator Henry Clay and Democratic Senator Stephen Douglas with the support of President Millard Fillmore. Any reason to fight? 1862, American Civil War. Union forces engaged Confederate troops at the Pea Ridge in northwestern Arkansas. 1876, Alexander Graham Bell was granted a patent for an invention he called the telephone. 1900, a German liner SS Kaiser Wilhelm de Gross becomes the first ship to send wireless signals to shore. 1902, Second Boer War. The Boers, led by Coos de la Rey, inflict the biggest defeat on the British since the beginning of the war at Trubusque. 1914, Prince William of Wied arrives in Albania to begin his reign as king. 1931, the Parliament House of Finland was officially inaugurated in Helsinki, Finland. 1936, prelude to World War II, in violation of the Locarno Pact and the Treaty of Versailles, Germany reoccupies the Rhineland. 1941, Günther Prien and the crew of the German submarine U-47, one of the most successful U-boats in World War II, disappear without a trace. No clue as to what happened to that U-boat. 1945, World War II, American troops seized the Ludendorff Bridge over the Rhine at Remagen. 1950, Cold War. Soviet Union issues a statement denying that Klaus Fuchs serves as a Soviet spy. 1951, Korean War, Operation Ripper. United Nations troops led by General Matthew Ridgeley began an assault against the Chinese forces. Also in 1951, Iranian Prime Minister Ali Razmara is assassinated by Khalil Tamasabi, member of the Islamic fundamentalist Fedayeen al-Islam, inside a mosque in Tehran. 1965, Bloody Sunday. Group of 600 civil rights marchers is brutally attacked by state and local police in Selma, Alabama. 1970, Mihailis Permaisuraton Rakyata Seminatara, Indonesia's provisional parliament, revokes Sukarno's mandate as president of Indonesia. 1968, Vietnam War. U.S. and South Vietnamese military began Operation Truong Quoc Dinh to rout out Viet Cong forces from the area around Mai Tho. 1971, Sheikh Mujibur Rahman, political root of the then East Pakistan, present-day Bangladesh, delivers his historic March 7th speech in the race course field in Dhaka. 1986, Challenger disaster. Divers from the USS Preserver locate the crew cabin of the Challenger on the ocean floor. 1987, Lu Massacre, Taiwanese military massacre of 19 unarmed Vietnamese refugees at Dong Gang, Lemu, and Kinmen. 1989, Iran and the UK break diplomatic relations after a fight over Salman Rushdie and his controversial novel, The Satanic Verses. I had an autographed copy, and we had a garage sale, and some slimy lowlife stole it. And none of the people working here did anything to stop them. 1993, the tugboat Thomas Heber sank off the coast of New Jersey. 2006, the terrorist organization Lashkar-e-Taiba coordinates a series of bombings in Varanasi in India. 2007, reform of the House of Lords. British House of Commons votes to make the upper chamber, the House of Lords, 100% elected. 2007, Garuda Indonesia Flight 200 crashes at Adi Sucipto International Airport in the special region of Yogyakarta, Indonesia, killed 21. 2009, the Royal Irish Republican Army kills two British soldiers and injures two others, and two civilians at Massarini Barracks, the first British military deaths in Northern Ireland since the end of the Troubles. And in 2021, at least 105 died and 600 are injured in the 2021 Bata explosions in Bata, Equatorial Guinea. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays observances, Christian Feast Day, Blessed Jose Alalo, Blessed Leonard Fedorov in the Russian Greek Catholic Church, Paputua and Felicity, Pierre-Henri Dory, Simeon Francois Bernot, part of the Korean martyrs, liberation of Iraqi Kurdistan, Teacher's Day in Albania, a lot of things going on. Let's see what else we got. Okay. In 321, Roman Emperor Constantine the First decrees that the Dies Solis Invicta, Sunday, is a day of rest in the empire. In 1530, English King Henry the Eighth's divorce request is denied by the Pope. 1560, the Christian fleet under Gian Andrea lands at Djerba, North Africa. 1621, John Peterzoon's Cohen's troops land on Lantour in the East Indies. 1633, Prince Frederick Henry appoints himself Viceroy of Limburg. He was the Prince of Orange. 1644, Massachusetts established the first two-chamber legislature in the colonies. 1696, the English King, William III, departs the Netherlands. 1774, King George III of Great Britain, Ireland, and Hanover charges the colonists in Boston with attempting to injure British commerce, which paved the way for the closing of the port to punish the colonists for the Boston Tea Party. 1778, Captain James Cook first sights the Oregon coast at Yakina Bay. 1798, the French army enters Rome. That was the birth of the Roman Republic. 1799, the Royal Institution of Great Britain is founded, dedicated to scientific research and education. 1801, Massachusetts enacts the first state voter registration law. 1808, Portugal's regent, Dom Juan IV, arrives in Rio de Janeiro. 1843, the first Catholic governor in the U.S., Edward Kavanaugh of Maine, takes office. 1847, U.S. General Winfield Scott occupies Veracruz, Mexico. 1848, in Hawaii, the Great Mahele, the Division of Lands, is signed. 1851, the poll tax levied on Russo-Polish Jews entering Austria-Galicia ends. 1852, Dutch telegraph traffic is regulated by law. 1854, Charles Muller patents the first U.S. sewing machine designed to stitch buttonholes. 1862, the Battle of Elkhorn Tavern. This is the second day. Generals Ben McCullough and James McIntosh are killed. 1876, the Battle of Gura. Ethiopian Emperor Yohannes beats the Egyptians. 1881, Southern University opens in New Orleans. 1887, North Carolina State University is founded by the North Carolina General Assembly. 1900, battle at Poplar Grove, South Africa. President Kruger flees. 1905, Arthur Conan Doyle publishes The Return of Sherlock Holmes collection in London, as a result of public pressure to revive his famous detective that he apparently killed off. 1906, Finnish Senate accepts universal suffrage except for the poor. 1911, U.S. sends 20,000 troops to the Mexican border. 1911, Willis Farnsworth of Petaluma, California patents the coin-operated locker. On this day in 1912, Roald Amundsen announces his discovery of the South Pole. Which he had actually located on December 14th, 1911. In 1917, the first jazz record released on a 78 by original Dixieland jazz band for the Victor Talking Machine Company. And any of those records would make you a nice return if you had one. On this day in 1918, President Woodrow Wilson authorizes the U.S. Army's Distinguished Service Medal. In 1918, World War I, Finland forms an alliance with Germany. 1921, on this date, the Red Army under Trotsky attacks sailors at Kronstadt Naval Base near St. Petersburg in Russia. In 1926, saw the first transatlantic telephone call, London and New York. 1927, an earthquake measuring 8 on the Richter scale strikes Tango, Japan. 1929, the first nonstop flight made from America to Asia across the Bering Strait, Nome to Cape to the North Cape. By Noel Wynn and Calvin Cripe for Wien Air Alaska. In 1930, New York Times, the ultra-liberal newspaper, finally agrees to capitalize the end in the word Negro. 1932, riots at the Ford factory in Dearborn, Michigan kill 4. 1939, Glamour magazine begins publishing. 1941, 50,000 British soldiers land in Greece during World War II on this date. And in 1941, British troops invade Abyssinia. You know it as Ethiopia. 1942, the first cadets graduate from flying school at Tuskegee, Alabama. 1944, on this date, Japan begins an offensive in Burma. 1945, there's an attack on the car of Netherlands SS police chief Hans Rauter by Dutch resistance. Rauter is injured but not killed. 1945, U.S. 9th Armored Division attacks Remagen, Germany, and crosses the Rhine. 1946, Bikini Atoll Islanders are evacuated by the U.S. government to make way for a nuclear testing site. I'm sorry, you have to leave. We're going to blow up your home. 1948, the Dodecanese Islands officially become part of Greece again. Up to that point, they'd been ended, had been ruled by Italian forces. 1955, the musical Peter Pan starring Mary Martin, Larry Hagman's mother, broadcast live on NBC as part of Producer Showcase. attracted a record 65 million viewers. This day in 1962, the Beatles made their broadcasting debut. Also on this date, 1962, there was a groundbreaking report called Smoking in Health, published by the British Royal College of Physicians, the first major medical report to warn about the dangers of smoking. Well, this day, 1966, the U.S. performed a nuclear test at the Nevada test site. This day, 1971, Egypt refuses to renew the Suez ceasefire. In 1973, the comet Kohoutek, discovered in Hamburg Observatory. In 1974, the USS Monitor, the Union ironclad, sunk in 1862 during the Civil War, is restored at Cape Hatteras. And finally, on this day in 1981, the first homicide took place at Disneyland. An 18-year-old was stabbed to death. Well, I think that pretty much has it. You know, we've been talking about a lot of strange things. UFOs, time travel. I got a request that I do some stories a little more down to earth. So how about we talk about some Hollywood murders? True crime cases of famous people at basically shelled it to famous or just like the rest of us. You know, there have been a lot of well-known folks who have met the fate of those of us less well known. The now much of the world literally is overwhelmed by celebrity. And whether it's the big stars that appear on the silver screen or reality TV like the Kardashians, they act like they're better than the rest of us, and we agree with them. And it's not exactly unheard of for there to be a dark side to these celebrities. As we see in just a few moments. Now, the first one I'm going to talk about is a man named Bob Crane. Now, he was front page news because of his role in the World War II sitcom Hogan's Heroes. And although the humor in that series was decidedly dark, he and his companions were POWs at a Nazi Stalag, the show was surprisingly upbeat and very popular. Now, it aired decades after the end of World War II, and by then the horrors of the war were forgotten by many. so an American audience felt comfortable enough to make light of some of the things that had happened. In every episode, Hogan, who was played by Bob Crane, would help his fellow captives act smart and play pranks on their bumbling Nazi guards. The show had a popular run for a good many years before it went off in the early 70s. And he wasn't really sure what to do with his Hollywood career at that point. Finally, he decided to go back into theatrical productions. Now, he'd always enjoyed theater, and it was relaxing for him to escape the Hollywood lights and cameras for a bit and perform for live audiences on stage. He was in a popular production called Beginner's Luck, which did very well. But he had another hobby, not as well known as his acting performances. He was a videographer. Now, he'd spent many, many years in front of the camera playing Hogan, but he had a later interest of being behind the camera. And he filmed all kinds of things. But what would be the most startling in the aftermath of his murder was the revelation he had a penchant for creating home sex tapes. He videotaped women in provocative poses. Sometimes he was in poses with those women, and on some occasions he even had the camera going to record a full-blown orgy that involved him and a number of other people. And while all this was going on, well, he turned up dead. Now, Victoria Ann Barry, Bob Crane's co-star from the theatrical production Beginner's Luck, was one of the first to happen upon that murder scene. She was concerned that he hadn't shown up for the Television Academy luncheon where he was scheduled to attend as with her. And they were both scheduled to do an interview about the production after the luncheon. And it wasn't like Bob to miss a chance for publicity, so she thought she'd head on over to his apartment and see what was going on, why he didn't show up. When she got there, noticed his vehicle was in the parking lot, so she assumed he had to be home. She knocked at the door and didn't get any response, and she doesn't know why, but she gave the doorknob a try and discovered it was unlocked. Well, not sure what else to do, she went inside. And she stepped in out of the Arizona heat into his cool apartment. Now, he had refrigerated air, which was a real luxury in the 1970s. And it was running full blast. And then she noticed stacks of magazines littering the floor and a coffee table. Video and camera equipment was strewn about the room, as a video camera on a tripod pointed directly at the couch. And this was no doubt where Bob recorded all his well-known home movies. And as she made her way to his bedroom, she noticed what she thought was somebody sleeping on the bed on their right side in a fetal position. And then she noticed that there was a dark pool of blood coming from that whoever that was head. And when she cut on the light, she saw it was coming from Bob's left temple. And the carnage was so bad, it actually covered his face. She wasn't sure if she was looking at Bob or maybe his close friend John Carpenter, both of whom had a similar profile. And as she looked closer, she saw something else odd. There appeared to be an electrical cord of some sort wrapped around the individual's throat that was in the bed. Well, whoever it was, this was not an accident. This man didn't fall and hit his head. He didn't wrap a cord around his neck and then ram his head into the wall. This is quite obviously murder. She ran out of the apartment and flagged down the first person she saw. It was a woman named Mary Lou Hawkins, a visiting mother of a resident, and requested her aid. She pleaded with the startled Ms. Hawkins to help me. There's a man in the apartment who's dead, and I'm afraid it's Bob. Well, for a woman who spent her entire career working in drama, this was no doubt the most dramatic line that Victoria ever uttered. It was Hawkins that got on the phone, called the Scottsdale Police Department. Scottsdale, Arizona is where Bob was living. When they arrived, it was obvious that the bludgeoned man was dead and couldn't do anything for him. Now, at this point in time, the body still hadn't been identified, and Victoria insisted to officers on the scene it could very well be Bob's friend John Carpenter who lay in the bed. Now, this theory was put to rest when John Carpenter himself rang the phone at Bob's place and talk to the police officers on the scene. Well, with Carpenter eliminated as a possible victim, it didn't take long for these brilliant investigators to deduce it was indeed Bob Crane who'd been murdered. Well, shortly after he turned up dead, investigators went all over his apartment building in an attempt to locate any potential witnesses. I mean, let's face it, it was a busy apartment complex, after all, and it was assumed that surely somebody heard something. But they went unit to unit and encountered residents who claimed they had heard a single solitary sound. So apparently he was silently bludgeoned to death. The only potential clue they did get came from a resident named Sandy Miller, who claimed to have seen something that struck her as odd the night before. She said she had seen Bob's car pull in, seen Bob Crane get out of it, followed closely by a heavyset individual who she'd never seen before. First potential suspect. They just didn't have a name to go with him. Now, such details are making investigators pause, because the severity of his injuries led them to believe from the outset that whoever killed him had to have been a very strong man. And the subsequent autopsy of Bob's body did indeed indicate that somebody with plenty of brute force at their disposal had unleashed terror on Bob Crane. With this limited bit of a lead in mind, investigators fanned out to speak with Bob's friends and colleagues to figure out what his activities were like off the set of Beginner's Luck. And they got an earful. It was then that the full range of Bob's prolific sex life became known. He had multiple sex partners at any time, and much of it was documented on film. Investigators leave his apartment with several bags of Bob's home videos and photographs. He'd videotaped so much of his time spent in that apartment as wondering if his own killing might be somehow on tape. Now, one of the early problems in the investigation, though, was a lack of control over the crime scene. Bob's adult son, Bob Jr., for example, was allowed to come over almost immediately after the murder and told he was free to take whatever he wanted. I mean, let's face it, it was understandable police would want to show this kind of compassion to the loved one of a murder victim, but it does fly in the face of normal forensic protocol. So boxes of potential crime scene evidence were allowed to go right out of his apartment, never to be seen again. Now, the problem with the investigation was that many of the investigators just didn't take this case seriously. There were a number of accounts of guys on the scene goofing off watching Bob's sex tapes rather than actually trying to solve the murder. One police investigator would recall sitting around with other investigators trying to discuss potential suspects. One of the guys irreverently shouted, "Put on the dirty movies." Now, this definitely wasn't a good start to a serious investigation. Nevertheless, the early days of the investigation did yield some clues. One thing, the autopsy determined the electrical cord around Bob's neck did not kill him. Seems it was wrapped around his throat after he'd already been bludgeoned to death. Now, the reason this might have been done after the murder remained a mystery. It was clear the actual murder weapon had to have been a heavy, solid steel object in order to inflict the massive damage that it did. Now, the closest lead investigators had on the suspect was actually that of John Carpenter, Bob's friend. No one, in fact, was quite as close as Carpenter when it came to Bob Crane. Carpenter, in fact, was seen in many of Crane's home movies. Even more intriguing, it was discovered Carpenter and Crane had actually been seen arguing the very day that Bob Crane died. Police subsequently got a warrant to search Carpenter's car, and it was in the car they found even more incriminating evidence. Bloodstains that appeared to belong to Bob Crane since they matched his blood type. Now, this was the 70s, before all we had all this forensic technology that could do DNA and what have you. Beyond the actual blood type, investigators are unable to conclusively determine the blood did indeed belong to Bob Crane, or when it was actually leaked, as it were. Well, despite the lack of a smoking gun, once Bob Crane's blood type was discovered in John Carpenter's car, Carpenter himself became a prime suspect. Now, initially, Arizona's Maricopa County DA was interested in pursuing this lead. So, amazingly enough, the case went cold.
Wouldn't be picked up again until 1990 when a detective by the name of Barry Vassal took another look at the case and managed to convince the DA to give it another try. Now, despite the years that had gone by, the new investigation uncovered something the original investigators missed. It was an old crime scene photograph that Detective Vassal thought clearly depicted brain tissue inside Carpenter's car. Now, although this was certainly a stab in the dark by anybody's estimation, this evidence was enough to bring John Carpenter in on charges of murder. Now, Carpenter's trial began in 1994, and during the course of the trial, Bob Crane's own son, Bob Jr., took the stand and testified his father was sick of Carpenter mooching off of him and was about to cut off the money train. It was Bob Crane Jr.'s understanding Bob Crane Sr. just ended his friendship with John Crane and Carpenter had killed him out of... with John Carpenter, and Carpenter killed Crane out of spite. Now, Carpenter and his defense team, of course, refuted this and presented statements from eyewitnesses supposed to tell the two palling around like best buddies the very day before the murder. They also convincingly argued that the original investigation into Bob Crane's death had been haphazard, claims original investigators such as... that were still around could only confirm. The idea had been brain tissue that couldn't be tested was found in a crime scene photo was ridiculed as absurd. The defense also conventionally argued Bob Crane's killer could have been any number of boyfriends or husbands of the women he slept with, who might have killed the man just out of sheer revenge. Now, Carpenter was ultimately found not guilty by the jury, and he would insist on his innocence until the day he died in 1998. Nevertheless, Maricopa County D.A. Rick Romley was convinced Carpenter was indeed the killer. And as late as 2015, he went on the record to state, "I'm convinced John Carpenter murdered Bob Crane." But at the end of the day, when all is said and done, this case is still officially unsolved. Then the next one we're going to talk about took place in Hollywood in May of 1998. The victim, Phil Hartman, who became a star as a result of Saturday Night Live. The suspect was his wife, Bryn Hartman. Now, she was brought to trial, but she committed suicide before being convicted in 1998. Now, as I say, he became famous on Saturday Night Live, where his skits are now legendary. But as much as he's known for his life work, he's also known for his, shall we say, unusual death, shot three times by his own wife before she took her own life. At least that's the story. Now, a native of Ontario, Canada, Phil was born September 24, 1948. His parents were of fairly modest means, and he and his brothers and sisters said they've grown up in some fairly cramped conditions. Eventually, his father was able to add two additional rooms to the family homestead, which alleviated some of the strain. And by the late 1950s, his family made the decision to leave Canada behind and move to the U.S., where Phil struggled to fit into community life outside the home and inside the home due to the number of his siblings, he felt unnoticed. Now, he came from a big family, no question about that, and his brother John tended to get all the positive attention because of his good looks, athletic ability, and natural charisma. Phil soon discovered the only way for him to stand out was to become as abrasive and obnoxious as possible. Later credited this compulsion to cause himself to get noticed as the ultimate drive that led him to become a comedian. Now, as he grew up, he was known as an A, B, and C student. Rarely would he get a D or an F, but he never tried hard enough academically to be on the honor roll either. Instead, his interest lay in the growing list of celebrities that he enjoyed impersonating. Rather than good academic grades, he is known around school for his hilarious takes on stars such as John Wayne, Bob Newhart, and Jonathan Winters. His spot-on impersonations got him the attention of fellow student John Holloway, with whom he shared a homeroom class. And as odd as they might have seemed to others, a favorite pastime of the pair was to go over to Holloway's house and watch old movies on mute so they could present their own parodied dialogue. Now, if you've ever seen the show Mystery Science Theater 3000, in which the narrators make remarks throughout these cheesy films, you get the idea what these two goofy guys were up to. But as strange as the pastime may have seemed to outsiders, it was actually stunts like this that served as preparation and dress rehearsal for God, and later become one of the greatest sketch artists ever to appear on Saturday Night Live. By the time he graduated from Westchester High School, June 17, 1966, he knew his true passion was somewhere outside the halls of academia. Even so, upon graduation, he made sure to sign up for classes at Santa Monica City College, where in between surfing with his friends on the beach, he took some classes. He eventually used his coursework at Santa Monica as a springboard to attend California State University. He ended up graduating with a bachelor's in fine art. Fresh out of school, he had some success with his artistic endeavors and at one point designed artwork for the music group America. Also married his first wife during this period, Gretchen Lewis. They divorced in 1972. By the mid-70s, he needed to get back to his comedic roots, and he hooked up with a local band of comedians who were dubbed the Groundlings. The famous member of this particular group was Paul Rubens, who would eventually develop the famous character Pee-wee Herman. Indeed, Phil Hartman would eventually come to make cameo appearances in the 1980s hit show Pee-wee's Playhouse. He starred as the absurd pirate, Captain Carl. In the guise of this character, Phil Hartman sang his own personal theme song. Now, this role provided Hartman instant notoriety, but it was in 1986 when he was recruited to join the cast of Saturday Night Live that his career really took off. Now, a lot of things happened in the meantime. Married his second wife, Lisa Strain, in 1982, divorced her in 1985. Remained on Saturday Night Live for 8 full seasons before he left the cast in 1994. And when he did, he left behind several memorable skits, including the infamous Crosby Show skit mimicking the Cosby Show, complete with guest Jamal Warner, who played Theo on Cosby. During the act, instead of being Bill Cosby, Phil Hartman played 1940s crooner Bing Crosby. But no doubt the most memorable moments of Hartman's tenure at Saturday Night Live was his unfrozen caveman lawyer, in which he played the part of a caveman who was thawed out from the Ice Age, went to law school, and became a lawyer. In this role, he came up with the famous catchphrase, "Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I'm just a caveman. Your world frightens and confuses me. That's why you should elect me to Congress." During his high-flying run at SNL, he married his third and final wife, Bryn Omdahl. They got married November 25, 1987. Although his friends were happy for him, they noted from the beginning that Bryn was possessive and easily jealous of her husband. Phil's ex-wife Lisa got a taste of this over-the-top jealous treatment herself when she sent Phil and Bryn a card congratulating the couple on their new child being born in 1988. And although Lisa was no longer married to Phil, they were still friendly and on good terms. And it was something that she did wish both all the best. Having a child is a unique occurrence. Admittedly, there are a lot of people who might feel a little unsettled to get any communication, even a nice one, from the ex-spouse of their wife or husband. But as a celebrity hobnob with a countless men and women on a regular basis, for Phil, it was just part of living. Regardless of how Bryn might have felt, her response was certainly in the extreme. After getting that congratulatory note, she sent back a rage-filled letter to Lisa in which she basically threatened to kill her if she didn't stay away from Phil. In light of the way things turned out, this might have been a red flag that should have been paid attention to. At any rate, after leaving SNL, Phil starred in a wide variety of small roles, the most famous of which was maybe the most surprising. He was cast for some voice acting for a character on the animated series The Simpsons. His first forays with the popular cartoon sitcom actually began before he left Saturday Night Live, and it'd be something he'd continue to do throughout his later years. In the show, he did the voiceover for a washed-up former actor named Troy McClure. And the character is based, in part, on Phil's own experiences of rejection, midlife crisis as an actor. This character was often shown appearing on The Simpsons television set during late-night infomercials, in which he always began, "Hello, I'm Tony McClure." You might remember him from such films as, and then he'd read off a few films. The character, of course, was a total gag, but Troy McClure would go on to become a cult favorite in the Simpsons universe. At any rate, while Phil experimented with these amusing side gigs, nobody was quite sure what Phil Hartman's next major move would be. Then came News Radio, a sitcom which cast Phil as the overbearing radio man, Bill McNeil. and the show would be fairly successful in its initial run. The future once again looked promising. Unfortunately, all this promise came to an end in 1998 when the unthinkable took place. In the lead-up to Phil Hartman's death, he and his wife Bryn's relationship had begun to deteriorate, and this was due in large part to her worsening addiction to drugs and alcohol. And the couple frequently fought over her substance abuse problems. And on May 28, 1998, one of these arguments escalated until it took a deadly turn. Early that morning, after a heated argument, Bryn picked up a gun and shot Phil Hartman several times. And after killing her husband, she proceeded to drink and snort cocaine before calling up her friend Douglas. Called Douglas about 3 in the morning. Asked Douglas if she can come over to his house, and he tells her it's late and she ought to stay home. Well, about 4 that morning, Douglas woke up to find Bryn banging on his door. Bryn was out of her mind, intoxicated, burst into his home, began to rant and rave about killing Phil. Well, he didn't take her seriously to begin with, figured it was just the booze talking. Eventually, she collapsed on the floor, only to wake up moments later and run to the bathroom and throw up. At one point, though, she produced a gun out of her purse, which Douglas immediately takes away from her. He examines the gun, and it initially appears that all 6 bullets are in that little gun, but that really wasn't the case. But based on his initial impression, Douglas was relieved, thinking her ramblings about shooting Phil were just products of her booze-induced imagination. But on second thought, he realized 3 of the bullets had been expended. Becoming concerned, he has Bryn drive back to her home with him. He followed in his car so he could check on Phil. When he entered the residence, he discovered the truth. He saw Phil's dead body stretched out on the bed and realized Bryn did indeed kill her husband. He called 911 upon finding Phil's body. And first response on the way, Bryn ran to the bedroom where Phil lay, locked herself in. Made one last frantic call to her sister, Kathy, asking her to take care of her kids before she picked up another gun and shot herself. Well, police broke through the locked doors of the bedroom shortly after that and found Bryn lying by her slain husband's side with a gun in her hand. Well, since it was clear in their minds who the killer was, the investigation ended with Bryn's death. Well, now, Phil Hartman's wife, of course, appeared to be the obvious suspect. And if the circumstances of her death hadn't been so obvious, one could imagine a few other suspects who would have been potentially emerged. I mean, Douglas, for one, could have been turned into a suspect. Investigators would have considered it possible he had staged the whole thing himself. Fortunately for Douglas, though, Bryn's guilt was obvious to everybody's mind. Her manic spiral was documented not just by Douglas, but also through phone call conversation between Bryn and her sister Kathy. Well, there's dialogue between her and the emergency personnel. Police were right at the scene just before Bryn killed herself, making all involved absolutely certain that she was indeed the killer. Now, there was no trial, so there was no further investigation. Everything ended when she took her own life the very same day she allegedly killed Phil Hartman. But the question in my mind is, did she really do it? Well, let's talk about the death of Denise Huber. She died in Hollywood, June of 1991. The suspect was a man named John Famolaro. He was convicted 6 years later. Now, Denise Huber was born November 22nd, 1967. Was only 23 when she went missing after attending a Morrissey concert in Hollywood. California native, she and her younger brother Jeff were raised by her father Dennis and her mother Ione in the greater Los Angeles area. She was still living with her parents at the time she vanished, but she was said to be fiercely independent. So independent of fact, she'd often come and go as she pleased without her or her parents giving it much of a second thought. She'd even gone with a family friend to London on one occasion. Everything turned out just fine. So when she failed to return from the Morrissey concert in 1991, her parents initially weren't all that concerned. She'd gone to the concert with her friend, Rob Calvert, Calvert was just a friend, and she had many guy friends. In fact, her male buddies no doubt found her attractive with her perfect figure, long brown hair, and bright blue eyes, but she was at a point in her life she wasn't looking for a serious relationship. She just wanted to have a good time with her friends. Initially, she was supposed to attend the concert with another male friend named Jason Snyder, but he had to cancel at the last minute when he found he couldn't get off work. She first met Jason at the old spaghetti factory where they both worked together, and as a past employee, she certainly understood how busy the place could get. Still wanted somebody to go with her, though. It was Jason that suggested a mutual friend and one-time co-worker, Rob, could have joined her for the show in his place. That's Rob Calvert, don't you know? Now, he didn't drive at the time, so it was, of course, Denise who provided the transportation with her snazzy blue 1988 Honda. According to Rob's later testimony, Denise arrived right on time and took him to the concert, which was located at the Forum in the vicinity of Hollywood Park Racetrack. And he said they had a great time with Denise, and although the two had a few drinks, he insisted it wasn't in excess. And they were able to let loose with the crowd, however, once Morrissey took the stage. He especially recalled they had both chanted out the artist's name, Morrissey, as he performed his hit song, "I'm the End of My Family Line." In fact, they were having so much fun that Rob even managed to get his arm around her as otherwise physically skittish friend. According to Rob's testimony, after the concert, Denise stepped over to the nearby payphone. This was a few years before cell phones became popular, and called their buddy Jason, since by that point in time he'd finished work. Invited Jason to meet up with her and Rob at a local Mexican diner called the El Paso Cantina, so they could all three hang out. Now, Rob said the roads were clogged with traffic as they made their way to the exit ramp for California's I-405 Interstate Highway. Nevertheless, Denise managed to maneuver her Honda well enough, and they arrived at the El Paso Cantina as they planned. Well, once they got to the cantina, they had a couple of drinks and listened to music on the restaurant's jukebox and waited for Snyder to arrive, but he wasn't able to make it. By the time the restaurant's bar gave their last call for alcohol, they decided they better head out. Now, Bob would later recall just one more stop before getting back to his house at a convenience store so they could buy some cigarettes. Last time he saw Denise, she was right in front of his house. She stopped to drop him off. He recalled how his seatbelt had jammed and he struggled to unlock it. Denise reached over and managed to free him, and the two talked and laughed for a few more minutes before Rob bid his friend farewell and got out of the car. Denise's parents knew Rob Calvert fairly well and considered him an honest, trustworthy young man. They were sure he'd serve as good company and need be protection for their daughter. Even if Denise had decided to crash at Rob's house after the concert, they wouldn't have given it a second thought. Only after Denise's mom called Rob the next morning to find that she found out he wasn't there. She wasn't there and hadn't spent the night, the family started to get concerned. Now, Rob, in fact, was positive. Denise says she was heading straight home to her parents' house immediately after she dropped him off, but she never arrived. It'd be a panic full 24 hours later that her abandoned car would be discovered on the side of the road. Now, in the aftermath of her disappearance, investigators spoke to several of her friends in order to get a better idea of both Denise and the potential circumstances of how she could have gone missing. Now, Rob Calvert, being the last person with her, of course, was an immediate suspect. And so was Jason Snyder, the co-worker that they had waited for. Another source of information, though, came by way of Denise's good friend, Tammy. Tammy hung out with Denise for some time. She had attended previous concerts with her, such as David Bowie in May and the Peachy Mode in August. Anxious fans, growing weary of waiting for the Peachy Mode group to come on stage, began to grow distressed. That's when troublemakers on the upper level decided to pour their drinks on people down below, and all hell broke loose. There was a bizarre spectacle of rioting fans in the audience as the band began to sing their song, "Everything Counts." As concert goers pushed and shoved each other, vocalist David Grann belted out the chorus. And there's one night among many that Tammy spent with Denise they wouldn't forget. And she was of key importance in the investigation in Denise's disappearance. Now, Denise's parents, Dennis and Ione, were growing increasingly worried after their daughter failed to come home on the morning of June 3rd, 1991. They tried to rationalize that maybe she has crashed at a friend's house, which wouldn't have been uncommon for their daughter. But a few phone calls to her friends she most likely would have been with made it clear this wasn't the case. Shortly after her disappearance, Denise's abandoned Honda was then found on the side of the road with a flat tire. Actually found by Denise's friend, Tammy. Tammy attempted to retrace the route Denise would have followed going home, and sure enough, found the blue Honda parked deserted on the shoulder of the busy freeway. Tammy had been called by Denise's mother the morning of her disappearance to see if she knew anything about her daughter. Concerned for her friend, she decided to drive around herself and look for her. Well, when she found the car, she immediately jumped on the phone. She went to a nearby convenience store for the payphone. Called up Denise's mother and father to let her know what she'd found. Denise's parents were then summoned to the scene and found the vehicle unlocked with Denise's keys inside, and they confirmed it was indeed their daughter's car. With Denise nowhere in sight and unsure what else to do, the parents decided to head home so they could call the police. Now, what a difference a cell phone would make. Today, if this had happened, the worried parents would have called the police as soon as they discovered the scene. But since they didn't have the luxury of a cell phone, they had to run back home and call 911. Once home, Dennis called the Newport Beach Police Department. After filling in the police with the details, they were instructed to call a tow truck to get the car and file a missing persons report. It's a horrible uncertainty to go through to have a loved one go missing, but no idea where they are and who they might be with, and the very act of having to file a missing persons report only confirms the awful terror this situation gives rise to. Shortly after these efforts were made, the police officers converged on the site of Denise's abandoned Honda. When they got to the scene, investigators quickly deduced the obvious. Denise wasn't in the vehicle. They fanned out with flashlights to scan the immediate vicinity to see if there's any further sign of the girl, or at least what might have happened to her. Another police officer, Jane Walker, was on the scene with a dog from the canine unit. She walked its dog around the car to see if it could pick up a scent, and it did. The dog pulled his handler some 75 feet in front of the Honda. Here it came to a rest and sat down and looked back at Jane Walker as if to say, well, she was here. The dog seemed to indicate Denise had walked or was forcibly moved some 75 feet in front of the car and in the trail went cold. She was either instantly teleported from that spot or the trail ceased because she got into another car. Quite obvious, a car must have parked some 75 feet in front of Denise's distress vehicle, and she was either willingly by coercion taken from the scene by another motorist. Well, the story is quite convoluted. And we'll be finishing this story in tomorrow's show, but for the moment, we're out of time. So until tomorrow at the same time, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly great evening.